Okay, this is Margot Nyer with the Sac State Oral History Program, and I'm conducting an interview with Jack Edwards, a retired game warden with the Department of Fish and Game. It's April 13th, 2012 at 5:15 p.m. And we're going to stop now for a sound check. Okay, Jack, I'm just going to ask you a few clarifying questions so that we can give context to the interview.
Okay.
All right. When were you born?
1948.
Okay. And how old are you now?
63.
Okay. And when did you start work with Department of Fish and Game?
May 12th, 1977.
And can you just briefly describe your professional advancement through FNG?
Hired on as a game warden, and went to my first assignment, which was Half Moon Bay. I was there for about 5 years, transferred back up to the Sacramento area and had the Elk Grove District for about 5 years. Promoted to captain in 1986, and then promoted to assistant chief would have been about 1990 or thereabouts. And then in 94, I took over control of the public affairs office and was promoted to deputy chief of patrol at that time, and worked in that office for another 5 or 6 years, and then transferred back over just to the patrol division and stayed there until my retirement, and I retired in 2003.
Perfect. All right, so where did you grow up?
Grew up in Southern California, a little town called Marino, which is in Riverside County, east of Riverside.
And where did you go to school when you were down there?
I went to school at Marino Elementary School, same school my dad went to, and then went to Alessandra Junior High School, and then to Marino Valley High School. My parents split up, so we ended up over in the Redlands area, and then over in Yucaipa, and I graduated over at Yucaipa High School, which is in San Bernardino County.
During that time, were you really outdoorsy?
Spent a lot of time in the outdoors. My dad hunted and fished, but he usually did that to get away from the family, I think. So I didn't really do much hunting and fishing with my dad. Did a little bit of fishing. Was never really good at fishing, but we did get out a couple of times. We'd go down to a little place called Railroad Canyon Lake. It's now called Canyon Lake Estates. They built houses all around it and turned it into a fancy neighborhood.
Oh, wow. And when would you say your love of the outdoors began?
Well, probably as a little kid, because we lived out in the sticks. We had a little grocery store and a post office, not even a gas station. So there was nothing out there. So if you wanted to have fun, if you wanted to do something, you spent your time outdoors. You'd get a bicycle and you'd ride off into the hills, or you'd hike and spent your whole time out there. Of course, I was a Boy Scout and spent a lot of time in the outdoors as a Boy Scout as well.
I grew up in Sonora, and we did the same stuff.
Yeah.
If you wanted to do anything, you were going to be...
You didn't have a movie theater, you didn't have video games, you didn't have any of that sort of thing. So it was, you know, get on your bike and go and hang out with friends, or go hike, or enjoy the outdoors.
So when did your interest in the Department of Fish and Game develop?
Well, I'd always had a small interest because one of the guys, I always called him Uncle Sleepy. He was a guy who was raised up with my dad. He is a fishing gamer. Worked for over 40 years in the Department of Fish and Game. And we would talk about fish and game whenever he would be getting together with my dad. You know, it was one of those things I always had in the back of my mind, but my mom had brainwashed me as a little child that I was going to grow up and become a dentist. So if you were to look at my school records where they asked you what you wanted to do when you grew up, I was always going to be a dentist. And then after I joined the Air Force and I got into the dental field as an Air Force rookie, and I decided this is not really what I want to do the rest of my life. I really enjoyed the outdoors much more. So my plan was that after I got out of the service, I was going to go on to college, get my degree. And I did. I went to UC Davis and got my degree in wildlife biology, with a plan on either becoming a wildlife biologist or a game warden. And I talked with Uncle Sleepy, and he said, if you want to be frustrated for the rest of your life, get a job as a biologist, because politics controls so much of what happens. If you want to do something good for wildlife, and just think about what you've been doing in college. How often did you sign a petition to save the panda or to do something like that that was really important to you as a college student? Well, as a game warden, you're on the front line. You see someone out there poaching, destroying a stream, causing any damage to our resources, you can put a stop to it. You don't have to study it for years. You can do something right now and you can make a difference. And I decided then that he's done it for 40 years. He knows more about it than I do. And I think I would really enjoy doing that sort of thing. And I was fortunate that I was working for County Parks at the time here in Sacramento County and was out of doors all the time while I was going to college at UC Davis in the Sac State. So I knew what it was like being in an enforcement role, even though I wasn't an enforcement officer. I was a park aide at the time. But I knew a lot about that side of the business. And I thought, yeah, that would be great to be a game warden. And no greater joy than finding someone who's violating the law, not just doing something that's illegal, but destroying a stream. Because stopping a poacher that's catching one extra fish or 10 extra fish, you save that particular fish maybe, but the guy that's out there with a bulldozer destroying that whole stream, that's thousands of fish and many years worth of fisheries that gets destroyed. So it would be nice to be able to be in a position where you can actually do that. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate enough in one case, in one small stream in Half Moon Bay area, that I did have a guy with a bulldozer in the stream, tearing up the stream to put a crossing in, and wasn't doing it correctly and wasn't doing it under a permit. And it was nice to be able to put a stop to that and walk out in the middle of the stream and get him off of that bulldozer and tell him that he was under arrest and maybe protect that stream in the future.
That is amazing. So how did you find out about him doing this?
I think on that particular one there was a report of muddy water coming down the stream. And so I started where I could find the muddy water and continued going upstream at every access point until I could find where this guy was at. And was able to hike into where he was and was able to stop that particular damage to the stream.
Was it a community tip that you got?
Yes. When you're a game warden, you have an average of about 1,000 square miles of area to cover. And that's yours 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the only way you can really keep an eye on all of it is you get to know your community, because it's their resource. It's not just mine. And when you get to know the people in your community and they care as much as for that resource as you do, they call you. And I mean, you may get a call at 2 o'clock in the morning when someone's out spotlighting deer or hunting illegally or fishing illegally or whatever. That's how you can actually make a difference. One person all by themselves covering 1,000 square miles can't happen. You really need that support of your community.
What was your territory like in Half Moon Bay area?
Half Moon Bay, I had the western half of San Mateo County. So I had everything from the Daly City area down to Santa Cruz area and from the ridge all the way to the ocean. So I had marine fisheries, had anadromous streams with steelhead in them, had pheasant clubs, deer clubs, lots of different kinds of activity.
So the community was really important.
Yes,
working that
because
area.
It was all small communities, and having been raised in a small community, it was a lot easier to feel comfortable getting to know the people. Mm-hmm. And you got to know the people in Half Moon Bay, the people in Pescadero, the people further south. And once you got to be a part of that community, then you're part of that team. Before that, you're an outsider, because when you come into a small community and you're the new guy, it was kind of strange because, you know, they would talk to you, but they really weren't sure they wanted to trust you. Mm-hmm. I think one of my favorite or most fond memories of part of that time was that there used to be a little coffee shop in Half Moon Bay called Johnny's. And I'd go into Johnny's and have a cup of coffee occasionally, and I noticed that there was a table in the corner that had a reserve sign on it. And that was where all the locals would come in and get together. And mm-hmm. I'd been there maybe 2 years, and in that period of time, I'd either sighted everyone in that table or a family member. And finally, one of the days, one of the guys said, "Jackie, I might as well come over and sit with us. You've already arrested all of us, so you're family now with us." You knew you were part of the community. And I think one of the important things, especially when you work a small community, is that you need to do your job the right way. You need to be fair. You don't show favoritism. I mean, these were nice people, but, you know, nice people do things wrong or screw up. And they knew that when they got a citation because they did something wrong. It wasn't personal. That was just my job, and my job was to protect that resource. And so when I was welcomed to their table, it was kind of like, okay, this is good. Now I'm a part of this community. And it got to be where I would get more calls for activity that was going on because they knew they had done wrong and accepted that they had done wrong and dealt with the citation, you know, went to court, paid their fine, that sort of thing. But then after that, that's when I would get more calls. There'd be somebody out in the middle of the night spotlighting, for example. I remember one time, I got a call about 2 o'clock in the morning, and one of my landowners had called He was at a poker game in Pescadero. He lived about 4 or 5 miles north of that. Said his daughter called, said there's someone out in my field. So I drive down to this area to see if I can find the people that were spotlighting deer on his pumpkin ranch. And found these people, made contact, and next thing I know, a vehicle comes driving up from the south where he had been hanging with his friends, you know, playing poker and having a good evening. And they all get out with shotguns. Mm-hmm. And these two people that I had stopped, they're looking around like, oh my God, what's going on? And it was nice to know that they had my back. They knew they called me out in the middle of the night, but they weren't going to let me do it all by myself. They were there for, give me a little backup to make sure everything was going to be okay.
That's one thing that really strikes me with the job that wardens have is the personal danger that you're always in. Because you do work alone, correct?
You do work alone. And as a matter of fact, on a night just like that, I remember one time I got a call from someone that there was some spotlighting activity going on. And so I drive down there and I see the vehicle working in the area. And that was an area where it was a lot of hills and a lot of valleys, so radio coverage was pretty limited. And so I'm driving along, keying my mic, waiting to hit a repeater before I'm going to put the red light on and pull this person over. I've got my lights off. I'm sneaking along behind them and keeping an eye on them. Finally, I was able to hit a repeater, tell the dispatch in San Francisco that I was on Stage Road and I was going to be making a stop. And then I did make the stop, and after that, I drove back up Stage Road, clicking on the mic until I could hit a repeater and then tell the dispatcher that everything was okay. I was all finished with it. But so yeah, you're out there most of the time. You're talking with people that, especially in the middle of the night, that are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. And no, you don't have backup. There's nobody sitting in the car beside you, unless like I did. I had a dog with me, but you're out there all by yourself.
Did you have one of the police trained dogs?
No, in those days you had a dog that you trained to help you sniff out, you know, birds or whatever that somebody may have hidden. And then you had a dog that hopefully you trained well enough that responded to commands so that the other person didn't know whether this dog was trained to, you know, attack or whatever. Mostly we trained our dogs not to lick them to death, but they didn't know what the dog was trained to do. They just knew that if I snapped my fingers and the dog jumped out of the truck and came and stood by my side, that they weren't sure they wanted to push it any further than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So, what was one of the more dangerous parts of the job? Or dangerous instance that
you
came across?
Well, it was always dangerous when you're working by yourself, especially at night. But it was also dangerous when you had if you write a ticket for a fishing game violation and the person doesn't show up in court, a warrant's issued. Well, all of the warrants were always sent back to the department, and it was our job to follow up and find that person and arrest them and take them to jail, because they had an outstanding warrant. And so occasionally we'd get together and we'd do a large warrant detail where maybe we'd be in downtown Oakland with a half a dozen wardens going in to neighborhoods that we really didn't know the neighborhoods, but we knew we were going in looking for people who had outstanding warrants. And sometimes that was kind of dangerous and kind of scary. I remember after I transferred to Sacramento, apparently the warden there before me didn't really like working warrants. So when I got my patrol car, there was a big box full of about 250 outstanding warrants that were still in his trunk. So I spent a whole lot of time in South Sacramento and Oak Park tracking people down and arresting them and taking them to jail. And you're usually doing this by yourself, and it can be a little scary. It's uncomfortable going into someone's house when you don't know exactly what's on the other side of that door. But,
right.
You know, that was the job.
So how long did you work in the Half Moon Bay, and when did you transfer to Sacramento?
Okay, Half Moon Bay, I was there from 77 to 81, transferred up to Elk Grove in 81.
Okay, and how long did you work in Elk Grove?
Elk Grove, I was there from 81 to 86, and then I promoted and went to headquarters.
Oh, okay. I'll ask you about headquarters later.
Okay. Okay.
What would you say, and you can interchange Elk Grove and Half Moon Bay, but what would you say a usual day on the job went like?
Well, your usual day, first of all, was determined by looking at what's going on the day before. So what's the season? What should be happening? What shouldn't be happening? Mm-hmm. So, for example, if opening season for deer was going to be on Saturday, well, then you might be looking at what am I going to be doing on Wednesday or Thursday or Friday, because is there a possibility that somebody's going to be out hunting early before the season starts? Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of folks, they don't want to wait until after the season starts, because then there's more hunters afield. Game may be a little scarcer or harder to find because there's people out there tromping around in the woods, so sometimes they'd go out a day early. So maybe you schedule your day on that one to be sure that you're working from the late afternoon and on into the evening, maybe until maybe 11 or 12 o'clock at night, because you wanted to be there working those areas when that's when the problem was. Or maybe you had a low tide coming up the next day, so you would schedule your work day so that you were out there working the low tide. So depending upon what the season was or what the situation was as far as tides go, then that would determine how your day would go. If it was during duck season, then you would be out there at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to get up with the ducks, to be there in case there were any early shooters. You might take off midday, go home and rest, and go back out at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon and work on into the evening and put the ducks to bed at the end of the evening. So depending upon your schedule, it is basically your job to figure out what you needed to do in your district at any given time and try to keep your hours to 8 hours a day, although you didn't usually do that. Mm-hmm. You wrote down 8 hours a day or less, but you tried to keep that way. But you worked what was necessary to work because that was your wildlife. That was your district. I mean, there wasn't someone that had the next shift. I didn't have 8 to 5 and somebody else came in at 5 o'clock and worked it until midnight. It was my responsibility to deal with what was going on every day, all day long. Mm-hmm. So you would adjust your schedule to try to do that. But on a regular day, you might get up and go out and do a patrol, drive around the areas. You might meet with some landowners along the way, find out what's going on, what kind of issues they've got, whether they've been seeing any problems, so that you could make a note of coming back at a particular time to look for a particular problem. You might be meeting up with a landowner to issue a permit. Maybe someone has a problem with depredation, which is you've got wildlife is destroying their crops. So if you've got a pumpkin farmer, deer seem to like pumpkin blossoms, so they would have problems with the deer coming in and eating the blossom. Well, if they eat the blossom, guess what? You don't have a pumpkin. Mm-hmm. So you would meet with them, find out what their problem was, determine whether or not it was a problem that would require a depredation permit, and if it was required, then you would issue the permit. It might be an issue and a permit to go out and haze or scare the animals away. It might be a permission to go out and take the animal that was causing the damage. So depending upon the issue, you would issue the permit, then you would be following up with them. If they did have to take a deer that was they're destroying their crop, then they would shoot the deer, they would contact you, you would go pick it up, you'd take it into one of the food kitchens. You know, I'd usually take mine into San Francisco to one of the soup kitchens, so they would use that deer for food for the homeless people that were there getting food.
That's something I watched on Wild Justice, and I was really pleased to see how they never wasted anything. Mm-hmm. That's really
right. I mean, when you have a case, you may end up taking, you know, the fish that they've taken the over limit of or whatever, and you secure that as evidence and you've got it in the freezer. When the case is adjudicated and the court tells you that it's released, then that product gets donated. I mean, I still remember the biggest, I worked on the coast for 10 years, no, 5 years. When I came to Sacramento area, my biggest abalone case was made here. And one would think, well, we don't have any abalone in Elk Grove. But it turns out that a friend of mine was working a case over in the Sea Ranch area and called me on the phone and says, Jackie, you got to be at the Elk Grove airport within the next hour and meet an airplane. Here's the tail number. It's going to be flying in there. They just left here with a huge ice chest full of abalone, big over limit. So I'm waiting at that airport when the airplane arrives and contact the owner of the airplane and tell him I'm there to take a look at his abalone. And he opens up the ice chest. He's got lots of abalone in this ice chest, several hundred of them.
Oh.
And, of course, I seized his abalone and wrote him the ticket for the over limit. After that case was adjudicated, there was a lady named Mama Marks out in the North Highlands area that ran a soup kitchen. And so they had enough abalone to have abalone chowder for months and months after that. But, you know, we didn't let it go to waste. It went to an appropriate charity somewhere in the area where you worked.
Excellent.
So that part was fun. Catching the bad guys was equally fun.
I bet. Must be a rush.
It is, especially when, you know, when you're young and doing this job, you're really not thinking as much about the danger. I mean, you're paying attention. You're cognizant of officer safety issues. But you're still out there in the middle of the night. And it's fun sneaking up on people and catching them doing their deeds. I think one of the most fun ones, one night I was working, this is one of those times I actually worked with another warden, and we met up and we went down to the American River, And we got down to this area where it was a big willow thicket. And so we made the decision on how we were going to split up. So Gary went upstream and I went downstream and we worked our way down. And I get down into this willow thicket on this little pathway and I see a fisherman out in front of me. This is about midnight. So it was closed fishing stream and it was closed hours. He's got a fish on the line. He's reeling the fish in and working his way down the stream. And I'm looking around. There's a fish laying in front of me. So he's already got one. And I'm wondering, where's Gary at? Because, you know, we both went in two different areas and I'm assuming I'm going to see Gary sooner or later, but I know I've got a guy in front of me that I need to deal with pretty soon, because pretty soon he's going to have that fish in and I'm going to be making contact with this guy. As he's moving downstream, I don't want him in this position where he's going to be able to see me come out, because he can throw his line into the river and take off running. Well, little did I know, Gary had worked his way from upstream through the willow thicket. He was standing about 4 or 5 feet behind me. Now, Gary's asking himself, as we talked later, where the heck is Jack? I've got a guy out in front of me with a fish on. I got this other guy down in front of me, squatted down. There's a fish in front of him. I don't know. Do I grab the guy here close to me that's got the fish in front of him? Where the heck is Jack at? And just about the time he was ready to jump on me, thinking I'm one of the bad guys, as I turn to get up and race out and grab the guy that's out by the water, he catches a glimpse of the shoulder patch and a little bit of moonlight on my shoulder. So luckily, we weren't in that gravel thicket wrestling with each other, which would have probably scared the other guy off and he would have taken off it. Anyway, so I jump up, I run out, and I grab the guy around the body in one hand to grab the fishing pole so he doesn't throw the evidence into the river and holler in his ear, "You're under arrest, fishing game." And this guy screamed bloody murder like a bear had come out of the woods and got him. Now that's a rush. It would have been a different kind of rush if Gary had jumped on me and we'd have been tussling in the woods there. Luckily, it turned out good, and Gary was there to back me up instead of try to take me to the ground and arrest me. Mm-hmm. But those are the kinds of things that are fun.
Yes, definitely. So, did you ever have a partner like Gary?
No, we never worked in pairs. Unless you had a particular detail, you always worked by yourself.
Okay, so only in special occasions you would work with another person.
Yeah, I always just had Sam, my dog.
So did you ever participate in any undercover work?
We did some undercover work, not as much as they do today, but it depends on really what you want to call undercover. We regularly worked out of uniform and worked in our own patrol districts. We occasionally worked out of uniform in a neighboring district. But when it comes to what most people would think of as undercover, which means that you never wear a uniform, that you're always working, you've gone through the process, you've got a fake name, fake ID, you've been moved from your regular location and you're in a new location and you're working down there and you may be there for months at a time. Most of that did not start back when I first became a game warden. I remember the first person that I knew of that had done any assignment like that was, I was working in my area, I was probably here in Elk Grove at the time, and noticed a transfer came through for a guy that was in the same academy class as I was. So I knew the name, and he had transferred up north into the area near Burney, California. And I'm thinking, how did he get transferred to Burney? He doesn't have enough seniority to get to Burney. Well, we found out later that he was transferred to Burney, but he did not show up as the game warden. He showed up and got a job at a gas station and lived and worked up there for almost a year to deal with an undercover assignment, to deal with the problems that were going on with some illegal activity up there. And after that year, he transferred back to his own district, but he worked really undercover.
So you guys didn't even know.
And most people didn't know that. And then about 10 years after that, we actually did form an undercover squad. And so there's a half a dozen or more folks that's all they do is work undercover. Because there's a lot of things that go on that you can't really get into unless you're in the middle of the community. And if you're not a part of the community, you're never going to get invited along. You're never going to get out there and see that kind of activity. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole different job.
So, would you say that the job was really different between Half Moon Bay and Elk Grove? I kind of picture this more like urban versus rural.
The only thing that was really different was that in Half Moon Bay there were larger parcels of property, and trespass and things like that were a big issue. When I got to my position in Half Moon Bay, almost all the properties were smaller. So you didn't have 200 or 300 or 400 acre parcels. And so most of the landowners dealt with trespass issues because they lived there on the properties. So they were able to deal with someone who was illegally on their property. And more often than not, they would call the sheriff for a trespass issue rather than calling a game warden. So that part of it was different. The other part was different was how you actually lived your life. When you're in Half Moon Bay, everybody knew who you were. They knew you were the game warden. They knew where you lived. They would drive by and check to see if you were parked at home or you were out on patrol. They'd even come by and leave a treasure for you occasionally. I mean, there, I came out one morning and there was this nice steelhead under my windshield wiper like it was a parking ticket with a note scratched on it. We got him and you didn't get us.
Oh my gosh.
And see, that sort of thing can happen in a small town. When I moved up to Elk Grove, although Elk Grove was a small community, I lived in South Sac for a little while before I moved into Elk Grove. Now I'm anonymous. I could actually spend my days off and go to a movie and not feel like everybody in the whole town knew where I was at. When I was in Half Moon Bay, if I wanted to take a day off, I'd always go over to San Mateo or somewhere else because I couldn't be off in Half Moon Bay because you are the game warden. You are the Department of Fish and Game for that whole part of the county. And you're that in that role 24/7. So you had to be more cognizant about what you did on Friday nights and Saturday nights or whatever because everybody knew everybody's business. So the rural versus the more metro, that's the real difference. Is you could actually be anonymous when you moved into a metro district, but you couldn't be anonymous when you were in a rural district.
Do you feel like the small town, they took it a little bit more personally, what you did for a job?
Sure, because almost everybody that you contacted and wrote citations to were local residents, except for marine fishing activity. Because when it comes to the abalone activity and the marine fishing activity, 90% of that issue came from over the hill. But when you had deer poaching, pheasant poaching, stream diversions, pollution, all of those things were locals. But it was only the out-of-towner that came in to spend the day fishing on the coast. That was the only time that you really dealt with someone that didn't live there. So it was a little more personal in the sense that you were dealing with people that you knew, or their kids, or their cousins. So that part was a lot different.
So in Half Moon Bay, you did a lot of, you were saying, fishing and working with marine life. Mm-hmm. What did you work more with here in Elk Grove?
In Elk Grove, it was a lot of fishing on the American River, because my district went from the American River to the Cosumnes River, from Highway 99, and then east out to the county line. So I had everything out past Rancho Murrieta out to the Amador County line on that site. So I had two rivers, one a major river with a lot of fishing activity, one with very little fishing activity because it was dry part of the year. There was a lot of farmers and ranchers, so you had some hunting and activity going on. Almost every railroad track that runs through any area, there's a lot of dove hunting activity. And then you got farther east into the county, then we had a lot more hunting activity. But it was mostly fishing and working warrants and that sort of thing.
How much time did you spend in court?
Rarely do you spend much time in court other than tracking cases. I don't know if they still do it today, but when I was a game warden, you filed all your own cases. You didn't turn things in to a supervisor or somebody else who managed your case file. You'd manage your case from the day you wrote the ticket all the way through until it was adjudicated. So you wrote the ticket, you wrote the arrest report, turned it in either to the DA or to the court, depending upon what the requirements were in your local jurisdiction. And if the person paid the bail, then it was done. If the person then asked for a trial, then you would show up in court. And so it was only a few percentage points of the times where you actually showed up in court. The more complicated cases, you would end up in court. So if you worked in a case, for example, I did an undercover case where I worked with a guy who was a taxidermist, went in, met with him, found out what he was doing and how he was doing it, rewrote up the report, got the search warrant, went in and did the search, seized all the evidence. Those kinds of cases end up in court. But your average, no fishing license, too many fish, undersized fish, most of those, the people that in those cases either paid the bail or show up and plead guilty and pay in court. So not a lot of court time.
What in particular was this taxidermist doing?
He had a whole lot of illegal critters. I mean, seals, things like that. Ringtail cat, puffins.
Really?
Lots of weird things.
I thought puffins were from Alaska.
Yes, but it doesn't mean that they don't show up in a taxidermist's facility in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. So, one thing that always struck me with the wardens is the space that you have to cover. Mm-hmm. Do you ever get help from other law enforcement agencies?
Occasionally, but rarely. When you're, especially when you're in a rural area, you'll find that there's one game warden, and at nighttime, like in Half Moon Bay, there was one highway patrolman that worked south from Half Moon Bay on Highway 1 and a different one that worked north up towards Pacifica. There might have been one on-call deputy. And so if you happen to be anywhere around any major roadways, then you would overlap a little bit, and if you saw somebody was pulled over with someone, then they would stop for me or I would stop for them. But it's not like you very rarely ever got together and went out and worked anything together. But you would see them on the roadside with someone pulled over, you'd pull in and be there to give them assistance if they needed it. And of all the time I was in Half Moon Bay, only one time did I pull over where the highway patrolman was wrestling with some guy on the ground and I helped him get the guy handcuffed. And
you just happened to be driving by?
Yeah. Just happened to be there. When you're the only two or three law enforcement officers in that area at night, I mean, the city of Half Moon Bay had its own police force, but all of eastern or western San Mateo County only had, usually at night, one deputy and two patrol officers and myself.
Okay. We talked a lot about community and how it's important in your job, but do you feel like maybe the public has a little bit of a misperception of what you do?
The public in general and in large part does, because you stop and think about where the people in the state of California live. Even look at voting patterns, you see the same thing. They're in LA, or the bigger, greater LA area, or they're in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Most of those people might have a connection to fishing, but almost none of them have a connection to hunting. And so they don't know what game wardens really do. They think game warden, park ranger, forest ranger, they're all the same thing. So they don't really understand what game wardens do. The more rural areas, they know what the game wardens do because the game warden talks to them and sees them. It's a part of that community. You get into a place like in the Bay Area, let's say if you're the San Mateo warden instead of the Half Moon Bay warden, or you're the San Francisco warden, you'll spend a lot of your time in fish markets, checking fish, making sure they had fish that were legal to be sold, fish that were not taken under a sport license. So you may spend your whole time and never go out and check a fisherman, but you're checking the markets. And most people don't know that fishing even does that. Or they go check the restaurants. I mean, I've checked every restaurant in the greater Sacramento area when I was a game warden here. I know which ones I would go eat at and which ones I wouldn't. Which ones were doing things legally, which ones were clean. But
do you still know?
I still know, but it's been so many years. Management could have changed a few times since then.
I might have to ask you the insights. So when did you move out of law enforcement?
When I retired.
Okay.
So it's 2003. Because even in headquarters, when I promoted to captain, I was still in enforcement. So at that, my first position at headquarters, I ran the statewide hunter education training program. So even though I worked in headquarters, every opener for deer season, abalone, whatever, I would go back out in the field and work.
When you were promoted to captain and in charge of, what did you call it?
Hunter safety.
Hunter safety education program. Did you find yourself inside more often though?
Yes, that's basically a full-time headquarters in the office type job, except for when you're out putting on training for hunter ed instructors. So I traveled a lot over the whole state instead of just working in one area. But most of the time was in the office pushing paper. Mm-hmm. But we did get to get out of the office every time for an opening season. So out of headquarters, that part was fun because I never worked abalone. I mean, I've never worked lobster in my district, because the lobster is mostly south part of the state. So I would go down to Southern California and I would go work a lobster opener with the local wardens. And then to make that trip worth the drive, then the following weekend I would go over to the foothills and I would work a deer opener. And then I would come back and then spend the next month or so in the office. And then maybe I'd go up to the Sierras and I'd work a deer opener. or it was an abalone low tide, I'd drive over to the coast and I'd spend a couple of days working with the local wardens working an abalone season or an abalone low tide day.
So there's a lot of travel involved.
So there's a lot of travel involved with that. So
did you enjoy being in the field more or with the headquarters
position? There's nothing as good as being a warden in the field. That is the best job in the whole wide world.
So you prefer that over?
Oh, yes. I mean, I enjoyed the headquarters assignment because each of us realizes, if we're honest with ourselves, that we're really good at some things and not as good at other things. And I always thought myself as a good warden, but not a great warden. I've known a lot of great wardens, but I was a good warden. But I was a lot better administrator. And I knew that I could do more for my fellow wardens as an administrator than I could do protecting just one district. And so I chose to promote. I wasn't planning on promoting to Hunter Red, but that was the opportunity that arose. But in headquarters, there was a lot of overlap of work. And so you could work on developing policies and guidelines and training programs that was going to be of more benefit to more wardens than what I was doing as just one warden in the field.
So what kind of policies did you work on that benefited?
Oh, we worked on every policy. We worked on better training, better equipment. When I was in the field, my first assignment, I showed up and they gave me an old beat-up car. And the equipment that I got was what we call high-graded, which meant that all the good stuff has been taken. You know, another warden may have come in and turned in their old binoculars and got the new binoculars. I mean, so the new guy that showed up in that position had all old leftover beat-up stuff. So we set up policies that had a better way of controlling that so that everybody had decent equipment. We made sure that we did a statewide effort in replacing equipment, not just doing it locally when the local budget would allow. So everybody had a good spotting scope. Everybody had binoculars. Everybody had a good firearm. Everybody had a good shotgun. Everybody had the equipment that they needed. So we did a lot more in making sure we provided for that local warden all the tools that they needed to do the job and to be safe. And that was very satisfying. Wasn't as much fun as sneaking up on somebody in the middle of the night, but it was a huge job satisfaction knowing that I was doing good things for all my troops out there. Mm-hmm. And they became your people. You know, they were your wardens throughout that whole state. That was pretty special. And then when we started our own academy, because originally when I came on, you would go to a local police or county sheriff's academy, but we finally opened our own academy. And so I got to teach at the academy. I did defense tactics training. I did training on scenarios where we would take a warden through a scenario, whether they were contacting a hunter or contacting a fisherman. And so it was kind of nice to be able to know that you're giving that warden a better opportunity to be prepared to be in the field as a solo warden than what I had when I first came on.
So what did you go through when you first came on?
I went to the Riverside County Sheriff's Academy. Okay, and every law enforcement officer in the state of California has to go through what's called basic post-training. And when I finished with that, they sent me to my district in Half Moon Bay and said, you need to work with Jerry, who's your neighboring warden. Well, I had Mondays and Tuesdays off, and Jerry had Wednesdays and Thursdays, or vice versa. So we worked Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Then it was my days off, and then it was his days off, and then he was busy. I think we got 3 days together, maybe four, and then I was on my own because balancing schedules wasn't working. And then after about 6 weeks, all the new wardens went up to a little town of Ione at the CDF Academy, and we had some fishing game training. Because up to that point, all we had was just basic law enforcement. So we had a little fishing game training, and then we were back on our own again. Several years ago, when we started our academy was almost twice as long as the other academies, because we had a full law enforcement academy that was required to be a law enforcement officer, and then we had all the fishing game stuff, so that the person who came out of that really knew how to be a fishing game warden. On top of that, we had a field training officer program where they were riding with an experienced officer for several weeks so that they were able to show that they could implement in the field what they had learned in the training academy, so that when they finished the FTO program, we knew that the likelihood of them being safe and successful as a game warden was much higher than what it was when we were just sort of thrown out there, here's your ticket book, here's your car, have fun. Mm-hmm.
What other policies or programs did you institute?
One of the other things that I did was that I knew that computers were one of the waves of the future, and this would have been back in the early 80s. And I knew that the department had nothing computerized at all, except over in the Marine Fisheries program, because the scientists over there did a lot of computer work. But as far as the rest of it, it really wasn't anything being done. And I knew that we had a chief patrol that was forward-thinking, and I was still a warden. I wasn't already a lieutenant, and I was going to be going for a captain's job. So I knew I needed to show that I had more to offer than someone who was already promoted to lieutenant. So I would go into the headquarters office, and I'd talk to the staff about getting some information, and I would go and set it up and computerize it, and then bring it back to it and give it to them. So before I made it to headquarters, I had already computerized most of our records. So we had that stuff going that when someone called from the field and needed information, it was all computerized and ready to go. Mm-hmm. So I did the first setup of all the computerization of our law enforcement branch, and was later, after I went to headquarters, able to hire a person to manage most of that work so we could start computerizing all of our citation data. We were able to computerize all of our permits. So when someone needed a permit for falconry, for example, falconry law was rather complicated. It said a person could have no more than 3 birds that they could transfer during a 24-month period. So we had to set it up so that we could track who had what kind of bird and how many they had transferred, so they were staying within the law. And then the other thing we computerized were all the people who had permits to possess wildlife. You know, in most states, you can have almost anything you want, but in California, it's pretty restricted. It's okay to have dogs and cats and other domestic animals, but we didn't really want people out there that didn't have the knowledge base to be in possession of Bengal tigers or lions or llamas or giraffes or anything else like that. And so we had a permitting section that handled the permits. But if, say, that you're a local officer or you're a local police officer in a town and you get a report that there's an African lion on the loose in your neighborhood, who owns that lion? Well, once I computerized it, they could call headquarters, and we could tell them exactly everybody within, you know, 3 miles, 5 miles, 10 miles of that location who had a permit to have one. They knew who to contact about tracking down and helping to capture that lion and put it back into captivity.
That would make it way more helpful.
Yes. So did a lot of that sort of thing. The other thing that I did was that we had one person who was doing a little bit of work with the intranet. And that was before anybody had ever heard of the World Wide Web. It was all text-based. And I got to working with a guy out of the Lodi area. He worked down the Bay Delta region. And he was also really interested in computerization and wanted to change the way we had our internet so we could actually provide information to the public. And so he wrote the first visual-based World Wide Web site for the Fish and Game Department. And then he left the department. I took over and basically ran the department's internet site for about 10 years. So that was something that was rather new and innovative. Long before most people even knew what the World Wide Web was, we were out there with one. And the department was one of the first departments that had a web presence.
Great.
So that was fun doing something new and innovative.
Well, technology changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it streamlines everything in a government or mm-hmm. business.
Yep, it does.
Are there any other ways that technology changed the job?
Some things became a lot easier to manage. If someone has done something wrong and the court has made the decision to take their license, by computerizing it, you can track that information. They've even gone way further than where it was when I was there, to the point that now they'll be able to, a person goes in to want to get a license, they can do a lookup and find out, well, no, you can't have a license. Your license has been revoked. Well, when I was first getting those kinds of things set up, we had one law in the books that said if you had 3 or more fishing citations in a 5-year period, the department could revoke your license. We'd have to go through a process of doing a revocation. Or if you had 3 or more hunting violations. So when we started computerizing the citation database, we were able then to do a lookup every month and say, okay, this person has 3 or more citations. We put the information together, send it back to the field. That person would then give us the rest of the information we needed. We would take it to the Fish and Game Commission and we would have their license revoked. Same thing with a trapper. If a trapper or a guide violates the law, then we can revoke their license. So having that computerization in place allowed us then to take charge of what was going on and better control over revoking the licensing privileges for commercial fishermen, trappers, guides, or hunters or fishers who violated three or more violations in a 3 or 5 year period. So it gave us a better handle on control of those kinds of issues. And then later on, California joined with all the Western states because there was a problem of the poacher from our state going to their state or vice versa. And so we ended up with a compact with all the Western states that if a person was revoked in our state, that they were also not allowed to hunt in that other state. Because the whole idea was you really wanted conservation to be a choice that they made, but there are those that choose not to do that. And so if you can't educate to solve the problem, then you adjudicate, and if that doesn't work, then you can put them in jail. But you wanted to do it at the lowest level. But there are some people who were just diehard poachers. And by sharing that information across all the Western states, we were able to protect the resource, not just in California, but in Nevada and Arizona and Utah and Colorado, as well as north to south. That part was kind of nice that we were able to bring all those kinds of things on board while I was at headquarters.
And you said you were promoted to lieutenant.
No, I skipped lieutenant. I promoted straight to captain.
Oh, okay.
Didn't get a chance to be a lieutenant.
Okay. I'm not as familiar with the
structure. Well, back when I first hired on, they had just created the lieutenant's position. Before that, you had a warden and a captain and an inspector and then the chief. Well, they changed things in the early 70s, so you had warden, lieutenant, captain, assistant chief, which was also called a regional patrol chief if you were out in the field, and then the chief. And so I went from warden to captain, and then captain to assistant chief, and then to deputy chief, and retired instead of making chief. Had all my years in.
So, deputy chief?
Deputy chief.
What did you do when you were?
Well, when I was the deputy chief, basically I was second in command in the patrol function, but I was also running the whole public affairs and conservation education program for the department. So I had a staff of great people who created our Outdoor Cal publication, who wrote the news releases, who dealt with all our education and outreach programs, Project Wild, the Hunter Education Program, all those kinds of things. And then I was the one that would work directly with the director, reviewed all the publications, all the news releases, made sure that what the director wanted to say was actually said in the way they wanted to say it. Worked a lot with the agency, because if it came out of our director's offices, a lot of times it had to go through the agency before it was released, because ultimately it's all controlled by the governor's office, because the director and the agency secretary are appointees of the governor. Mm-hmm. So we'd all had to make sure it spoke with the voice of the governor. So I did all of that, and I also was supervisor over the guy that ran our air services unit.
The what unit?
Air services.
Air services.
And I supervised the guy that ran our statewide telecommunications unit. So I had lots of irons in the fire.
So what does it take to supervise those units?
Well, if you've got good people, almost nothing. And I think the thing I learned from my chief patrol, that was going to be Dwayne Johnson at the time when I was promoted, was that if you have good people, you give them the tools to do the job that they need to do and get the heck out of their way, they can do great things. And the other thing he taught us was that you make sure you give them credit for the great things that they do, because then they will do more great things. And you can only look good by giving them that opportunity. I still remember the first day that I got the job as the deputy chief and I took over the conservation education unit. They really weren't too pleased about being under the law enforcement branch. And they really weren't sure this warden guy was doing trying to be in charge of their programs. What did I know about publishing a magazine? What did I know about public affairs? What did I know about writing a press release? And so the first thing I did is I sat down with each of the people in the unit. I still remember talking with Alexia. She was the one to handle our Outdoor Cal at the time. So I sat down with Alexia and I said, okay, Alexia, what do you need to do your job? And she looked at me with a dumbfounded look on her face, because she was expecting, like she's seen in the past, that I was going to go in there and tell her how to write a magazine, because that's quite often what supervisors do. Mm-hmm. Especially if they know a little bit, they think they know it all. Well, I didn't know anything, and I knew that. I knew she knew how to do it. I've been reading that thing for years. I knew she knew how to create a great magazine. But no matter how great you are at creating it, there are still going to be obstacles in your way. And so my job, as far as I was concerned, was to make sure that she didn't have any obstacles in her way. If she needed help getting someone from Wildlife Programs Branch or the director's office to sign off on things so she could get things done in a timely fashion, then my job was to make sure that happened for her. My job wasn't to control what she did. My job was to make it so that she could do what she was supposed to be doing. And when you sit down with each of your people and do that, all you need to do is just stay out of the way. Let them do what they can do, because the guy that was in charge of air services, he knew airplanes forwards and backwards. I had a pilot's license. I knew a little bit about airplanes, but I didn't know how to run a statewide air services unit, but he did. All I needed to do for him was to make sure he had the tools he needed to do his job.
I didn't realize the Department of Fish and Game also controlled air services.
Well, at the time, we had 7 people, and we had about that many airplanes. Airplanes in Southern California, Fresno, and Redding, and Sacramento. And so they spend part of their time working with wildlife programs or with fisheries, going out and flying over and doing surveys of wildlife. Or they've got tags on fish like sturgeon that are moving up down the Sacramento River, and they're flying over that to figure out where the fish are at that they've got tagged. They also, if you've watched Wild Justice, they do a lot of the nighttime patrol, looking for the spotlighters. So we have a whole air services unit that does that. They also have one of their planes set up that they go out and they did all the planting of all the trout in all the Sierra lakes. So we have an air services unit. We've got a marine unit. I mean, when you've got, 1,100 miles of coastline and all the rest of the state of California to cover, it takes all those kinds of tools to do it. Got to have the boats, got to have the airplanes, you got to have the ATVs, motorcycles, etc.
Must take a lot of money.
It does.
I in my research, I realized that that's probably one of the most contentious political debates right now going on with the Department of Fish and Game.
There's always a challenge because so much of what the department does is not really noticed. I mean, to be an effective game warden, a lot of the time you're out there sneaking around to see what's going on. You do spend time, out in front talking to people, but a lot of time it's, you go out to look and see what's going on, and then you determine, do I need to make a contact or not? Because when you're by yourself, you can go over by where there's, let's say, a lake, and you get a vantage point, and you get your spotting scope out, and you look and you see who's fishing. You make your notes as to who's fishing, who's wearing what kind of fishing pole they've got, etc. Then you can walk down and you make contact. Well, if there's 20 or 30 people along a stream bank, by the time you get to the fourth or fifth one, the rest of them are, if they were doing something wrong, are no longer doing it. And so then when you make contact and they don't have a fishing pole anymore, or they put that second fishing pole away or whatever, you already got your notes about what was going on. So how you spend your time sometimes is very obvious, but you may have spent an hour before that watching them that they didn't see. So a lot of times people don't know that there's even a game warden around. You watch these people, you can tell by what they're doing. They're catching their fish, they put them on the stringer, they're right there. Another group of people, you might watch them, they put them on their stringer and they take the stringer down 30 or 40 yards from where they're at, and then they hide it in the bushes. Well, you're going to make a contact there. The one that's not doing anything wrong, you may have watched them for 20 or 30 minutes, and then you go on and you check something else because that person doesn't need the contact. You got so many hours a day and you still have that 1,000 square miles you've got to cover. So a lot of times people don't know that the game warden is out there or what they do because they don't really see them.
Does the state government recognize?
Some in state government do recognize and some do not. Everything in state government is competing interests. There's only so many dollars in the general fund. And when you cut that pie up into lots of little parts, everybody wants a piece of it. Quite often the piece that the Fish and Game Department gets is a small piece. I mean, there was a time that everything in the Department of Fish and Game was self-funded. Through license sales and that sort of thing, they had the funds to do all the jobs that they needed to do. But as costs of things go up, you soon get to the point where you cannot raise the cost of a license anymore, or else you will end up with fewer license sales. And then there's the realization that we're not protecting this resource just for that fisherman or just for that hunter. We're protecting the resource for the people of the state. And so finally, there was funds available from the general fund to help cover some of those costs in the department. But once you are using general fund money, now you're competing with every other state agency that needs those funds. So as funds become less because of, you know, economic cycles and that sort of thing, then it's a lot harder to do the job.
Was any of your time spent as an administrator used to try to get more funds?
Yes, because every single year you had created a budget for every one of your programs, and then you'd put that whole package together for our finance unit to go over and fight the battles with the Department of Finance. So if you were a captain or higher, you were managing a budget for every program that you had. You also were doing the same sort of thing on the legislative side, because if you needed legislative changes, then you were drafting legislative requests that would go to the legislative unit to go to the legislature to try to change laws to make it easier to do the job. So there's lots of that administrative work that you were dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Recently, there's been a lot of discussion in government about whether to give Fish and Game more money mm-hmm. or to cut it.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you feel about those discussions?
Well, it depends upon whether it's an honest discussion or a BS discussion. When the governor says, if I don't get my tax proposal passed, I'm going to cut the Department of Fish and Game and this other department and this other department, that's political BS. We, as a department, have no control over whether he can get an initiative passed in this state. Why should any individual department be punished because he can't get a tax initiative passed? But in general, every department probably needs more money. Fish and Game is no different than any other. It costs more for salaries, it costs more for cars. If you got in your car today, you know it costs more for gas. So no matter which department you're talking about, it's going to take more funds to do the job you're doing. And when you look at the department from the Fish and Game Enforcement side, which is where I spent most of my career, 250 game wardens in this whole state, 6,000 or 7,000 highway patrol officers, 20,000 or 30,000 correctional officers. If they doubled our salary and doubled our budget in Fish and Game for patrol, it would be negligible. It's a rounding error on some of these other budgets. So there are times that you think it's kind of ridiculous that we don't get the funding that we need for our very small department, because it's nothing compared to general services or corrections or highway patrol or any other major department.
Another thing I've noticed is the pay disparity between law enforcement officers and Fish and Game wardens.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Well, most of us that chose to become game wardens didn't do it for the dollars. It would have been nice to have been paid. The law says that there should be equal pay for equal work. But that's not a fact of life. It may be the law, but it's not what happens in the real world. When I first hired on in 77, Highway Patrol was 5% ahead of game wardens in salary. Park rangers were 5% below us, and correctional officers were 5% below that. Now, correctional officers and Highway Patrol make about the same money today. Park rangers and game wardens are about the same today. But there's about a 25 to 30% disparity between the Highway Patrol and correctional officers and the game warden and the park ranger. And when it comes to the kind of work they do, we are all, except for correctional officers, we are all, you know, talk about park rangers, game wardens, and patrol officers, Highway Patrol officers. We're all statewide police officers. We're all uniformed officers. We all go on patrol. The work we do is almost the same. The Highway Patrol officer has his assignment, and he or she works most of the highways. The game warden has all of the rest of the state doing the same kind of law enforcement work. The park ranger is a lot like a regular city officer because they have that law enforcement assignment normally within the parks or within the surrounding community. They should all be making the same money. They shouldn't be differentiating because of politics. And what happened many years ago, the Highway Patrol has a very effective lobby. If you've got 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 people arguing for legislation, or 350 people or 250 people arguing for legislation, who do you think they listen to over in the legislature? Highway Patrol has a law on the books that says that their pay will be based upon the 5 major departments, law enforcement agencies within the state of California. So they got legislation that controlled what their pay was. So when Oakland or LA gets a higher wage, then the CHP can automatically get that same higher wage. So it's not fair. It should be the same all the way across the board.
Is there anything that can be done to...
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, depending upon how you look at it, collective bargaining was given to the state the last time Jerry Brown was governor. And it has changed the way things are done to a certain extent. And a lot of times when you try to go to the legislature to get salary inequities dealt with, they will tell you, especially if you're a small group, no, that's now under the authority of collective bargaining. You need to go back and bargain for higher salaries or wages or benefits. But if you are a large entity like corrections, they were able to get legislation through. When you put enough money in the hands of legislators, you can get laws changed. If you take 30,000 people and each one put $100 up a month, you've got a pretty big pocket of money to convince legislators to change laws. If you've got 250 people, they could give up their whole paycheck every month, and it wouldn't come close to the political pack that something like corrections would have. So when you get right down to it, it's not just about what's fair and what's right. It's what people are able to do in the way of manipulating their legislators to change laws to suit their particular interest. And that part's unfair.
Why don't we? It's been about an hour.
Okay.
Don't want to exhaust you.
All right.
So why don't we bring this to a close, but there's one question that I'd like to ask you.
Sure.
Well, a couple questions. Would you recommend this job as a game warden to somebody today?
Sure. With the pros and cons, there is nothing as great as being a game warden. I see it as being in a job where you get to spend your time outdoors, unless you choose to promote. You get to deal with people who are enjoying life. You're talking to people who are mostly hunting and fishing, having a good time. When your day-to-day contact is with people who are recreating, that's all good. You talk about fishing, you talk about hunting, you talk about the great times in the outdoors, and that's a wonderful thing to do. A regular law enforcement job, when do you talk to people? When they've screwed up. You pull them over because they're driving too fast. You go to their home because there's a domestic disturbance. At the end of the day, that law enforcement officer has nothing but negatives to look at. And that's what he carries or she carries home with them at the end of the day. Yeah, we deal with some of those. We deal with a few diehard poachers. You know, we're out there all by ourselves in the middle of a deer camp in the middle of the night, and they're all drinking, and it's a little crazy and dangerous. But 99% of the time, we're out there talking to people who love being in the outdoors. Love it as much as we do. On top of that, they give me a paycheck every month to get to go out there and do that. On top of that, they gave me a patrol car. I'd never had a car, so, well, the first one was terrible, but after that, I had pretty decent patrol cars or trucks, depending on where I was at. I could take my dog with me. They didn't tell me what time to start and what time to stop. Matter of fact, more often than not, they told me to quit working so much because it's fun. It's fun being out there. Would have been nice if they paid us a little more. Yeah, that'd be great. But there's just nothing like the joy of being out there and being with people who are enjoying their lives, and you get to enjoy it with them and share with them the fun of being in the outdoors. You know, we're here, this other little party, we just loved being able to put a stop to the damage that the others were doing, to stop that poacher, to get that bulldozer out of the stream and to protect that stream so that our kids and our grandkids are going to have fish to see in that stream. So, yeah, I'd do it again.
So you're definitely satisfied with your career?
Oh, wouldn't change it at all. Loved every bit of it.
Great.
I mean, my last day of work, I found out I was supposed to have been gone the day before. I worked my job all the way, even the administrative part of it. I was there because I enjoyed it and I knew I was doing good things for the people that I worked with all the way till I was done. I never was sour about the job. I mean, there were things that were negative occasionally, but I wouldn't trade a bit of it.
Great. Well, I think that's where we should end it, but anything else that you'd like to add?
No, just it's just the greatest job there is.
Great. Well, thanks so much, John.
Hey, you're welcome.